On Sunday, September 8th at 11 p.m., Sugar and My Bowl will present composer and pianist Michelle Rosewoman. 2013 marks the 30th year of Michelle Rosewoman's New Yoruba, a musical celebration of Cuba in America. We will also check in with the founder and president of the Caribbean Cultural Center, Dr. Martha Morena Vega, who will discuss her latest documentary titled Let the Spirits Move You, The Evolution of Spiritist Traditions in Puerto Rico. That's Sunday, September 8th at 11 p.m. right here on WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org on the web.
My name's Joyce Jones. You're listening to Sugar in My Bowl. Our guest for this evening is Michelle Rosewoman. She has a project, the New Yoruba Project. It's been 30 years since it was initially presented at the Public Theater. But we're going to start the program off with Dr. Martha Moreno Vega. She is the president and founder of the Caribbean Cultural Center. I'll mention the complete name right now because I'm sort of like in between stuff. But let's listen to Nina and prepare ourselves for Michelle Rosewoman. First off, I'd like to apologize to Harvey at in Michigan. I won't be able to play that. What you wanted. Wah. But stay tuned. This is WBAI New York, 99.5 FM. Sugar in My Bowl. Coming up now.
I want some sugar. My bowl.
Hi, my name is Joyce Jones, and I'm on the phone with Dr. Martha Moreno Vega, the president and founder of the Caribbean Cultural Center. And I'm on the phone with you right now, Dr. Moreno Vega, because of your latest documentary, Let the Spirits Move You. Could you tell us about that?
Well, we're working on a documentary looking at spiritism, I guess, for common languages, mediumship, right? How a spirit talks through mediums, or in our culture, espiritistas, and that divine knowledge that is shared and how it's shared and how it has influenced our cultural traditions throughout time. And we're finding in doing the documentary that I'm starting from Native American roots through our African European roots. There has been a continuous, right, search and understanding of how spirit works. And the documentary focuses on how spirit works and has worked with Puerto Rico. We're looking at Puerto Rico because the documentary we did before, When the Spirit Sends Mambo, was focused on Cuba.
Mm-hmm.
And this documentary is focused on Puerto Rico because there's little information on spiritual practices and African influence in Puerto Rico. So we wanted to focus this documentary there.
Now, I understand you were successful in your Kickstarter attempt.
Yes, we were. We were very excited that our community supported the effort. And we just came back from a trip to Puerto Rico. And in fact, we're going back to do a few more interviews before shutting down the interviewing process and then going into the editing process. Our projections are for the documentary to be ready for the spring.
Okay. Now, I understand there's a screening coming up.
Yes, on September 14th, we're doing a screening at Aaron Davis Hall in New York. And the reason we sort of focused on doing these screenings of the unfinished and short version of the documentary is because we want audience feedback. These are topics that although everybody knows about, you know, mediums and spiritists, people are shy to talk about or share information.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that we're finding is that in showing the documentary, we just showed it in Puerto Rico, the short documentary, and we also showed it at NJPAC, that the audience reaction and information that they have about either personal experience or familial experiences have helped us in our research and has helped us in formulating and envisioning the final documentary. So we wanted to do as many as possible before we go into editing to make sure that we get the feel and the sense not only of the research that we're doing as the film producers, but also assure that we have the involvement of the voices of our community and the knowledge of our community.
Oh, great. So is there more that you're going to need from the public in addition to the input? Are you set financially as a result of the Kickstarter campaign?
Yes, we are.
Oh, excellent.
We feel that we will do an excellent job with the resources we have been able to gather. You know, money is always an issue, right? You can do more whistles and bangs and, you know, and stuff. But I think that we'll come out with a quality project.
Excellent.
And a product that our communities will be proud of in presenting the story of our experience.
Now, I have that the Work in Progress special screening will take place on September 14th at 7 p.m. at Aaron Davis Hall, Theater B.
Right.
Okay. And there's, we can't say prices over the air, but...
Yes, but there is a price. There is an entry fee.
Yes, there's a scale from, there's an advance price, there's an at-door price, and there's a student and senior price.
Yes.
And people can find out more about that where?
They could go to our website, cccadi.org, our Facebook page, and get more information. Or certainly they can call the Caribbean Cultural Center, 212-307-7420, extension 3002.
Could you repeat the number, please?
212-307-7420, extension 3002.
Is there anything more you'd like to share about the documentary, Dr. Morena Vega?
I think that the important thing for us is that oftentimes these traditions are seen as negative,
mm-hmm.
or are seen as sort of people are either mentally unstable or, you know, kind of clownish or magical, sort of like, you know, pulling rabbits out of a hat.
Mm.
And, you know, part of the vision and mission of the documentary is to show that there is divine knowledge and intelligence, that people have developed a gift and have this gift has been sustained over time throughout our community. It has nothing to do with race. It has nothing to do with culture. It has nothing to do with ethnicity in terms of being able to have the spiritual intelligence present.
Mm-hmm.
Present in all of our cultures, and it takes different forms in our culture, right, depending on the groups that are having the experience.
Right.
But the fact remains that over time we've been able to understand that there is an intelligence, a divine intelligence that continues and the voices of people who have gone before us and continue to communicate in ways that are meaningful, right, to people who are, let's say, on Earth, right, actual, and since we're dealing so much with virtual and actual, right?
Right, right.
People who are, you know, in their live bodies, right, can also communicate with those that have left.
Right.
And that intelligence is not lost.
Well, thank you so much, Dr. Martha Moreno-Vega of the Caribbean Cultural Center. I look forward to seeing the screening. Hopefully other people will join me on September 14th at Aaron Davis Hall. And hopefully it will generate effective and useful feedback.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much for the opportunity.
That was Martha Moreno-Vega, the president and founder of the Caribbean Cultural Center, complete name, Caribbean Cultural Center African Diaspora Institute. Get that right. And she was talking about the upcoming film. What? You know, that's what I get for juggling. Yeah, there's just so much going on around here. Let the spirits move you. And let's see. And as mentioned, there will be a special screening at the at Aaron Davis Hall on the 14th of September. And you can find out more about that at the Caribbean Cultural Center website, which is ccc3cadi.org. That's cccadi.org. And what we're listening to right now and what I'm talking over is Michelle Rosewoman's wonderful piano playing on In Praise of the Spiritual Guides, Egun. And that's from Michelle Rosewoman's New Yoruba, produced by Michelle Rosewoman, and it's also produced by guitarist Liberty Elman. We didn't get a chance to talk about Liberty Elman, but anyway, there's a lot more that Michelle Rosewoman has to talk about. And I'll let you know later about the lineup, and we're going to be talking about it anyway. As a matter of fact, Michelle Roseroman has a lot to say about the lineup and the changes in the lineup. Stay tuned. This is WBAI New York, 99.5 FM. Sugar in my bowl. Michelle Roseroman is the guest. Thank you, Dr. Martha Moreno-Vega. Stay tuned.
Hi, my name is Joyce Jones, and I am here with, what's your name, ma'am?
Michelle Rosewoman. What did you say? What's your name, ma'am?
Madam. Thank you for joining Sugar in My Bowl.
Good to be here.
And thank you for allowing this time in your space.
It's my pleasure.
Now, I want to start from the beginning, but first let me say congratulations on your latest release, Michelle Rosewoman's New Yoruba 2-CD set.
So first let me say, where does it all begin? And then let me say, yeah, thank you, because I'm really excited.
Yeah. Now, speaking of the beginning, you were born in Oakland, California?
Right.
What was it like when you were growing up there?
Very active politically, music, really an interesting place. Always has been, always probably will be. And my family was very active in the same ways, politically, musically, artistically. My home was pretty much full of art, music, and politics.
Now, I understand your parents had a record shop.
They did, yeah. When I was 3 or 4, they started a record shop. So that was a great source of music and also a summer job.
Right. What did they carry?
Oh, all kind of music. Just all kind of stuff. They had listening booths, and they were the last to have those. I remember that so clearly because, you know, they'd unwrap the recordings, and people would go in and listen, and they'd wrap them back up, and that was just the way it worked.
Nice.
I thought that was great.
Did you ever go into the booths?
Oh, yeah. I used to sit in there and listen to all kinds of stuff.
What did you listen to?
Well, let's see. I remember hearing, really, my first, were selecting my own jazz records to listen to, because in my home we had all kind of stuff. I heard a lot of, my mother loved Ella. They loved singers in general. From the jazz world, I heard a lot of classic jazz, you know, Oscar Peterson. We had those old compilations, like 78s, the whole volumes of everything. So, and my father grew up in New York and was really into jazz. We also listened a lot to music from around the world. They call world music now, but it was just a lot of calypso, music from the mountains of Peru and Chile, from Indonesian gamelan music, Indian music, a lot of kind of spiritually based folkloric music. And then there was just the music of the time, which was Motown R&B, and that was everywhere. And my brother had bands, and he was a little older than I, and we had musician friends live down the street, and so we, you know, we were listening to all the great R&B vocalists of the time, which to this day, I probably listen to that almost more than anything else still. I just love the voice. And then the lyrics, they meant so much in the arrangements. And the music sometimes was real simple, but the depth of everything was, it was just really beautiful, touching. And the lyrics had a purpose. They were positive, and they meant things. And there was a lot of political thrust, even in the R&B songs, so especially reflected. So that was all a part of what I related to as well. Strong blues, strong gospel, strong jazz, strong R&B, and very intense political time. When I was born in, you know, 1953, I'm 60. And so the late 50s, the 60s and the 70s were kind of deep.
Right.
Folks still didn't have voting rights.
Right.
And to realize how that was not long ago at all. And during my childhood, Martin Luther King, John F. Kennedy, Malcolm X, everybody was killed one after the other. And it was, the Black Panthers were very active. And
they had a chapter in Oakland.
Yeah, it was a hotbed.
Yeah.
And for good reason, because the police at that time were the worst in the country, from what I remember. And there was a three-letter word that everybody used everywhere I went to describe the police at that time.
Okay.
And that described it.
Sure.
And, you know, so anyway, it was intense that way. But the music and the politics all mixed together. And my mother was an amazing visual artist. And I invite everybody to see her work at my Facebook page. I have an album of her art called Esteras Art. And a lot of the way I hear, write, play, compose, when I look at her work, I realize where it came from. A lot of transparency, a lot of things within things, a lot of detail, and a sense of color that was very healing, pleasant, unusual, unique to her. She's steeped in the classics, but she painted and did her work from her imagination and that which came through her. And she manifested a lot of spirit on earth through her work, and I look at her stuff, I see new things in it all the time.
Is she a painter or sculptor? Well, for the people who aren't.
I was pointing. But a lot of oil painting, a lot of watercolor, as well as graphics like aqua tinting, metal etchings. She experimented with batik and tie-dye, and she had a printing press for a long time. She's very experimental, but again, steeped in classics, you know. I think it's fair to say she was extraordinary, just not famous.
Okay. Let's talk about your mentor. One of your mentors, the pianist Ed Kelly. Tell us something about him.
Ed, my heart and one of two mentors in my life. I met him when I was about 18. Let's see, to tell about Ed means to kind of tell this little short story of how I tried to get into UC Berkeley, where they had nothing of interest to me, but it was kind of in the plan. My parents wanted me to go there. And I auditioned for the music department, and I improvised for my audition, and they rejected me. So then I had to audition for an ear training class, and the woman said, "Well, why aren't you going for a major in music?" And I said, "Well, I did, but they didn't accept me." She slammed her fist on the table. She said, "I disagree with their decision." And the next thing I knew, I was in. So during that first couple months there, where there was nothing but 16th to 18th century classical harmony and music, I heard about a community college that had a big band that needed a piano player, and I went to audition. I got in, and that was Laney in Oakland, Laney Junior College, and Ed Kelly taught there in the way that Ed taught at that time, which was pretty wordless and all, "Hey, Ed, how do you do this? Come here, Mick." I was Mick, and Mickey just showed me a hands-on, you know. He'd walk into the class and just sit down and play and say, "Who's that?" So I'd say, "Al Garner. Who's that? Bud Powell. Who's that? Come on, Ed, that's you. Don't be trying to fool us." Within 3 months, I had left UC Berkeley. I just phased on out, and I was exactly where I was supposed to be. I was excited. I was up in the music I wanted to be in. At that time, when I got in the big band, it was a blues and F. I couldn't even read chord symbols, but I could improvise some blues. So that was the beginning for me of just everything gelling and making sense in terms of my direction. And Ed Kelly was a one and only incredibly laid-back person and player that was like in the Blues Hall of Fame, Gospel Hall of Fame. It was a great organist that played in church and bridged the gap between church and jazz, because he challenged that. He brought jazz into the churches against a lot of people's opinion as to what he should do, and he would just say, "Hey, listen to this and tell me if you think this could be the devil's music." So he played with a lot of folks. He was under-recorded more than anybody I know. He only ever did two records as a leader, and he was never recorded at his full capacity. He's a great, great, great piano player. I don't have enough words. I have recordings. I have things that show his greatness. Video. I did post a solo piano version of something he did on YouTube. People can find it. It was from a duo concert we did.
Thank you.
What an honor. That's what's so beautiful about this music, that even before I left and came here, the year I came here, he and I had a double bill at the Keystone Corner, which Todd Barkett ran, you know.
Right.
It was a Monday night, and he played solo, and I had my band there. And then years later, Yoshi's, Jazz and Flight did a series, and they had me and Ed playing duo with Tootie Heath and Ray Drummond.
Right.
So, and it's, when I look at that, it's painful for me. Not because Ed's gone, but because I had still so much to learn from Ed. Because it's funny, because he barely moves, and he says so much with so little. And he's a big guy, with he could get tense, and I got little hands, and I used to try to get those tense. I get it by straddling the notes. But I was just in a hurry. I was really young still. I've slowed down a bit. I like it laid back now in ways, you know, that everybody's always rushing everything to me now. And I'm sure that's how I appeared to folks then, you know. But Ed was a huge influence. I'm proud to say that he was really proud of me. And so much I strive for Ed to come through me with when I play, because he was so laid back. Asintao, we say, in the other line of music, when it comes to bata and things from the folkloric world, you know, the difference between the old school and the new school is the old school is more, it sits down, asintao, you sat down, you just settled, it's settled, and nowhere to run to. And that's a beautiful feeling in the music, so Ed is always a source of that for me. And he was very spiritual in his touch. He's a big guy with big hands, but his touch was so delicate it would make you cry, you know. Just a lot of things about him, and not a lot of resource to hear Ed, but people can find stuff. And everything I get my hands on, I try to make it available online.
Thank you for that. I saw the video, and people should go to YouTube and just put in Ed Kelly and Michelle Rosewoman, and you'll hear it yourself. You came to New York in 1978. Why?
Music. Well, you know, I was around the Keystone a lot and meeting a lot of musicians from here. I had left the Bay Area for a few years. I lived in Washington State. I came back in 75. In 75 to 78, well, I had gone to Boston for a minute in 73, and I had met a guitarist, Michael Gregory Jackson, that played with Oliver Lake. I didn't know Oliver. And when I moved back to the Bay Area in 75, I was staying in a house. I didn't have a place to stay yet. And Michael was in town with the saxophonist Oliver Lake. I got in touch with Michael. And Michael, turned out, was staying not far from where I was staying. So he came by to visit. And he walked in the door with Baikita Carroll, who was one of the founding members of the Black Artist Group. And Baikita lived up the street. And Michael was staying next door to him. And Oliver was staying with Baikita. And the house Michael was staying in was renting rooms. So that was it. I moved in next door to Baikita. And for the next 3 years was really steeped in the Black Artist Group and AACM music. And I met everybody through Baikita, because they all stayed with him. And began working with Baikita and Oliver, Julius Hemphill, before I came here. Oliver gave me my first gig here. So I was meeting a lot of New York-based musicians. My mind was very open. I was writing a lot, and I had formed groups, and one of my explorations was in depth with Butch Morris, who was out there at the time. So I didn't find a lot of people that were of like mind in terms of musically what they wanted to do. But the people I met from New York at the Keystone and all the music I was hearing there was really getting me excited. And a lot of them were New York-based musicians. And then I met Cecil Taylor, and I met Jimmy Lyons, and Jimmy was so beautiful. God bless him. So many we lost so young that who imagine what could have come musically, but they did a lot in the time they were here, like a shooting star with a short life. But Jimmy encouraged me to move to New York. A lot of people did. And then I just felt that it was coming. It was like, because my father was from here, I used to visit as a child, and I used to say, I would never want to live here. I used to visit a lot and liked it. And then I said, oh, Lord, I feel like it's pulling me. I have a feeling I'm going to end up in New York. And little by little, it just drew me in that regard. And then I came just to check things out in 77. And where we're sitting right now, there's a gap I have to fill. At Laney, where I met Ed Kelly, in the summertime, I saw a flyer on an old wooden street poles and a class in Afro-Cuban percussion. And I went to that class. And that was the beginning of my in-depth exploration of pure Cuban folkloric music, especially the non-secular, which is what was being taught by Marcus Gordon and a partner of his. Marcus Gordon was my first teacher. And first thing I learned were songs for the Orishas and sacred rhythms, 6/8 bembe rhythms and things like that. So when I came to New York in 77, Margaret said, hey, go over to the Drum and Percussion Center. My friend Carol Steele works there. She's a percussionist that worked with a lot of pop bands and kind of commercial bands. So I went down there and I was talking to her, and this woman walked in and to buy something. So I stepped back and I heard the woman ask her, are you still teaching? And she was saying no. And I was pointing to me because I was teaching at that point, teaching basic Cuban percussion in San Francisco. So I was pointing to me. So Carol said, but she does. And so then I set up a lesson with this woman, and I'm sitting in the apartment right now that was across the hall from where she lived, where I came to give her a lesson in 77, and I inquired about the building. I was just open when I came here. I was open. I visited Oliver and people I knew. I was out hearing the music, and I had a feeling that it could lead to something. And she told me this. People were leaving this apartment, introduced me. It was a loft, very raw. At that time, we had what's called a fixture fee. They wanted $2,000 to have the place, and they were leaving in 6 months. So I went home, I ran home, worked, sent money. They held it for me. They left before I was ready to come. They sublet it for 3 months, and I slid on in May of 1978. So it was just the whole sequence, the music, and it was through a lot of things, through my involvement with the drums and the folklore, have panned out to what my life is today. At that point when I started studying those traditions, really, and I say it recently often because it's just true, it's really when my musical path was born. And I didn't realize it then because I was deep into jazz already. And I got into the folklore. And they were very parallel worlds at that time. Nobody was into both. Nobody was combining those idioms. But for me, without my knowing it, that's where this all began in terms of where I am in this moment with New Yoruba 30 years later and everything.
In my putting my questions together, I saw it was obvious that the overlap was there. And so I wasn't quite sure how to ask what and mm-hmm. at what point, because mm-hmm. it was probably happening simultaneously.
Oh,
but
the worlds of your music.
But Orlando Puntillo Rios, when did you meet him?
I met Puntillo when he came, 80, 81. So my first performance, I had gone to, I was talking to Baquita. We were talking about Jerry Allen. And I was reminding him where I met her first, which was when I went to play at D.C. Space in Washington, D.C. with Baquita's band that included Julius Hemphill, Abdul Wadud. I think he had Firon Akhlaq. And he had me on congas and piano.
Oh, okay.
And downstairs there was somebody playing congas in the coffee house. And in between I went down and I met him and we jammed and whatnot. So that turned out to be a New York-based percussionist, Skip Burney. It was called Brinquito. And that was, I guess, 70, same year I got here, or early 79. And a little later in 79, I did my first concert as a leader in New York at PS 41. It's a school on, I think, West 11th, right near 6th Avenue. And somebody kind of fronted me that whole $500 that covered the entire event, because
wow.
I think they let me have the room free and I just paid musicians. I had Baquita on trumpet, Abdul Wadud on cello, Skip Burney on congas, and myself on piano. So that was my first as a leader. And who was there but Verna Gillis, who ran Soundscape? You familiar?
No. Oh. Tell me about Soundscape.
Yeah, Soundscape was a space that Verna ran on 52nd Street between 9th and 10th Avenue. A big old loft kind of space. And Verna did field recordings for Folkways. She was deeply involved with folklore music from around the world. But there she was at my fairly avant-garde. Not really, because I always got the roots there. You know, I had the congas, you know.
Mm-hmm.
We were dealing with time and rhythm with a lot of stuff on top of it, let's say. And instead of bass, I had cello. So it's very experimental. But Verna was very involved in all that music as well. She's one person in whom these worlds also came together. She was presenting all of this at Soundscape. When the Marielitos came in force for the first time in the early 80s, Soundscape became the place where we all met and began to experiment with throwing these worlds together musically, jazz and Cuban music. Daniel Ponce, Orlando Puntillo Rios, Ignacio Berroa, Paquito when he came, the people that were around, Nicky Marrero, Andy Gonzalez, just the whole world of percussionists. And some of the very first friends of mine here were percussionists because, as mentioned, I play congas.
Right.
I was really into studying it. So they all circled around Puntillo. And I wasn't sitting down as much. it was a different kind of environment here than on the West Coast. It was just more aggressive. And as a female, it just felt that I had to push harder and hang tougher. And I was here to develop my world of jazz as a composer and pianist. Really, that's what brought me to New York was jazz. One of the things is that playing congas is not good for my hands for piano. Very, very relevant to why I didn't continue to play out, because I'm playing. You know, I'm here studying some stuff that in depth, and I've learned more in the last few years than I have in a long time. But Puntilla saw what I was hearing musically, because I had started to hear the folkloric music in a contemporary jazz setting. And I spoke about this before, but I literally heard it in my dreams. I was hearing specifically that song for Obatala, that sequence of songs for Obatala. That's the one that, you know, everybody seems to see as the hit, you know.
Oh.
You know, because it's real funky, because the bata are like the original funk.
Thank you.
there's nothing funkier than some of the rhythms that are traditional to the Bata drums. And the amazing thing is that Bata are speaking the Yoruba language. And the fact that that's a language being spoken through the drum with such a sophisticated, intricate system of rhythm, the whole thing is otherworldly, let's just say. And you know it had to come from something big. Not everybody believes the same way, so I'll speak in broad terms.
Right. Well, you studied Bata, right?
I have studied without playing.
Okay.
For many, many, many years, because in Puntilla invited me immediately into a lot of things that really women weren't that involved in. He invited me to the Bata classes, but not to play,
okay,
but to learn. And in his world, women didn't play Bata.
Right.
And for me, I didn't have the need to challenge that, because I was learning so much. I was beginning to form a repertoire. Little by little, he had me singing with his group and playing piano with Nueva Generacion, you know, on certain things. He used piano, and he had me in the coro a lot. The chorus, I keep discovering videos of stuff I was a part of that I barely remember.
Wow.
It was just like a whirlwind of both worlds, you know, because
sure,
meanwhile I'm playing with Billy Hart, Rufus Reed, Freddie Waits, you know.
Well, you recorded with Billy Bang.
Yeah, that was one of my first recordings, yeah.
Right.
But in the first years, I was already hooking up with people like John Stubblefield and some of the more traditional players, besides the whole St. Louis contingent that was here, and the more avant-garde players like Bang.
What was that group that you played with? There is a Latin group. Los
Kimi. Kimi. Yeah, it's a songo group, which was a new rhythm at the time out of Cuba. And songo used traps, congas, and didn't use bongo. And the piano and the bass had a lot of freedom, more so than in straight-up salsa music. And there was a lot of, even before it got to be such a part of Latin music, there was a lot of jazz vocabulary kind of already up in the songo stuff. And it was really fun. And I met some folks at a traditional gathering of people into the folkloric world of music and spirituality. And we got to talking, and they had a band, and they said they needed a piano player. And the next thing I knew, I was rehearsing with Los Kimi, which turned out to be my very first recording. And I didn't think I was done in the studio. I thought they were having me back when I left on tour with Billy Bang for Europe, where we recorded.
And where you recorded your first release as a leader.
Yeah. Next, yeah, exactly. Yeah, through the Soul Note Studios. But while we were recording with Bang in Europe on tour, Los Kimi finished the recording. So that became the first recording I ever did. Billy Bang's became the second. And then my follow-up with the Soul Note recording was the third I ever did, my first as a leader, on which I had by Kita Carroll.
Hi. How's your mama? Hi, this is Roy Ayers. When I'm in New York, I listen to WBAI 99.5 FM and WBAI.org on the web.
Cuando él va para una fiesta, a la fuerza quiere bailar. Y si las chicas no lo aceptan, el baile quiere acabar.
Yeah. tomes un poco de malafo y fumes una zunga, usted verá que todos sus problemas se van a acabar. Amigo, y de un despojo con un pasaragüey, pero un despojo se acará, se acará, se
WBAI New York 99.5 FM. Sugar My Bowl is the name of this program. Michelle Rosewoman is the guest for the evening.
Michelle,
as mentioned on the previous recording by Los Kimi, El Guapo. What we're listening to right now is Ya, Woman Born on Thursday. Billy Bang Quintet, Rainbow Gladiator is the name of the release. Billy Bang on violin, Charles Tyler alto sax and baritone sax, Michelle Rosewoman on piano, Wilbur Morris on bass, and Dennis Charles on drums. That's a 1981 Soul Note release. Before that, we heard El Guapo, Los Kimi from El Songo, from Kim Records. I don't have a date for that. Don't know why, but I don't. But it's Los Kimi, L-O-S-K-I-M-Y. Before that, we heard Natural Light, Obatala, from Michelle Rosewoman, Michelle Rosewoman's new Yoruba release that's going to be released on Tuesday. That's it. Tuesday, September 10th. And that's a 2013 Advanced Dance Discs. Before that, we heard You Send Me, which is from a YouTube video of Michelle Rosewoman and Ed Kelly, the duo pianos. Before that, we heard Divine Passage, Elegua. We started off the Michelle Rosewoman segment with that, and we ended the exchange with Martha Moreno Vega, Dr. Martha Moreno Vega, of the Caribbean Cultural Center. Because there's more. Caribbean Cultural Center, African Diaspora Institute. I want to make sure the whole name is out here. We ended that exchange with In Praise of Spiritual Guides. I need to check in with Hank Williams and the bandstand. Stay tuned.
Good evening, jazz fans. This is Hank Williams, and welcome to On the Bandstand for September 8th. This is the segment of the show where we bring you aerial listings of Sugar and My Bowl guests so you can experience them live. Our guest for this show, Michelle Rosewoman, will be performing with her new Yoruba ensemble at Dizzy's Club on Monday, September 30th and Tuesday, October 1st. Go to jalc.org/dizzies for more info on these events. That's jalc.org/dizzies. Bobby Sanabria will be at New York City's Birdland with the Poochie Amanda Jones Quintet on September 19th. Go to birdlandjazz.com for details on this show. That's birdlandjazz.com. Dee Dee Bridgewater is playing Billie Holiday in the musical Lady Day, which begins previews on September 19th at the Little Schubert Theater on West 42nd Street. For more info on that, you can see LadyDayTheMusical.com. That's LadyDayTheMusical.com. Pianist Randy Weston will be appearing with his African Rhythms Quartet at the House of the Lord Church at 415 Atlantic Avenue in downtown Brooklyn on Saturday, September 21st, 2 o'clock, in a tribute to Dr. John Henrik Clark. Call 347-907-0629 for advance tickets or details. That's 347-907-0629. Or if you're online, you can look up the events page on Facebook. Pianist John Medeski has three upcoming area shows with John Zorn as part of the John Zorn at 60 celebration. They'll be at Columbia University's Miller Theater on September 27th and have two shows at Manhattan's Les Poissons Rouges Club on Bleecker Street on the 29th. See ZornAt60.com for info on all of these shows. That's ZornAt60, the number 60, .com for info. Finally, organist Akiko Saruga and her trio will be appearing at The Garage, 99 7th Avenue South in New York City. 10:45 p.m. show on September 28th. GarageRest.com has your details. GarageRest.com. If you've missed anything, you can see the listings at the Sugar in My Bowl blog. Go to our website, sugarinmybowl.org, and click on the link for the blog. You can also find tonight's playlist and audio from this and previous shows. Finally, a reminder that WBAI is still in serious financial trouble. Help keep Sugar and all your other favorite shows on air by pledging whatever you can. You can go to give2, that's the number 2, WBAI.org. This is Hank Williams signing off, and I'll see you next time on The Bandstand.
Thank you, Hank Williams. And what we're listening to right now is Michelle Rosewoman from The Source. This is her first release as a leader, and as mentioned. Stay tuned for more Sugar in My Bowl. We have a ticket giveaway, and gosh, I need to find that phone number. Maybe I can find it while this song is on. Stay tuned. So hate talking over this, but I have to give you a phone number to call. It is 212-650, I think it is. That's 212-650-8976. Tickets to see Michelle Rosewoman at Dizzy's Club Coca-Cola, as it is called, September 30th, Monday, 7:30 show. Stay tuned!
And then as for Puntilla, he brought a lot of stuff here that wasn't here before, and particularly the arara tradition from Dahomey, which is very prominent in Cuban folklore music. It's not only Yoruba from Nigeria. There's also the Congo, Dahomey, and Nigeria are very strong in Cuba and very much all mixed into the folklore traditions. So Puntilla, there was no voice like his anywhere, and he was sharing knowledge that nobody had shared yet. And it was the first time we had someone U.S.-based that was that open. And Puntilla was a scout, because to manifest that music here, it really wasn't well known yet, and he couldn't find players that knew what he needed them to know, so he started teaching like crazy, you know. And he spotted those who had it and pulled them into his circle. He kept me close. And little by little, I realized that I was forming an entire repertoire of music. A lot of stuff I already had written fit really well with folkloric elements because of how influenced I had been by listening to Bata and Rumba traditions. So within my writing, I would find that there were certain rhythms that fit there very naturally.
Now, if I noticed correctly, correct me if I'm wrong, but by the second release as a leader, you started to incorporate the Orisha songs, the folkloric songs.
Yeah, although not vocally, but instrumentally. And on my Quintessence recording, I did Vamp for Ochun, and I did something called For Now and Forever, which has been a part of the New Yoruba repertoire since the beginning, Por Ahora y Para Siempre, which is purely instrumental. Mm-hmm. With Bata throughout.
Is that the one that also has Howard Johnson on tuba?
On the new recording?
Right.
Yeah, there's trombone and tuba on, Vincent Gardner on trombone. I started to really conceive this ensemble, New Yoruba, and I had the instrumental stuff already where I was working the bata rhythms and rumba into stuff I had written. And then I started to arrange some of the songs that Puntilla especially brought here and loved, where his voice resonated, where he did a concert at the Public Theater with his group that was one of the most beautiful I'd ever heard, with a lot of this a cappella, arara stuff that it just used tonalities, melodies, rhythms, and vocal techniques that none of the Yoruba stuff was like that. It was different. So I applied for a grant to the NEA for the whole concept, the New Yoruba, a musical celebration of Cuban America featuring Orlando Puntilla Rios. Got the grant, debuted at the Public Theater in 1983 featuring Puntilla, and that was the birth of the ensemble, and here it is 30 years later.
And once you performed the New Yoruba at the Public Theater, you started touring that, didn't you?
I think the 1983 December was the concert, and in 84, September, October, or October, November, I had a 2.5-week European tour. That first New Yoruba group had, it was 14-piece, and I like to mention the personnel because it includes all these people we've been talking about, because I really just thought of who I was associated with, who I had natural connections with, and that's what I formed the band from. So I had Oliver Lake, who gave me my first gig in New York, by Keita Carroll. And Russell Siddiq is also from St. Louis, and he lived in California, and we had a group called the Lunar Ensemble. That's the group that played the Keystone Corner before I moved back to New York. John Stubblefield, Howard Johnson, and Bob Stewart was
two
the
tubas.
Section, right? Yeah. I had Rufus Reed on bass. I had Firon Akhlaf on drums, who I'd met through Oliver. I had Orlando Puntilla Rios with Gene Golden, Eddie Rodriguez, Olufemi Mitchell singing, and Oscar Hernandez singing, and Kelvin Bell on guitar, also from St. Louis. The touring group was a little different. It was Anthony Cox on bass, same horn section. Actually, the only difference was Anthony Cox on bass, and Puntilla didn't go. He didn't have papers at the time. I had Eddie Bobay, Eddie Rodriguez, Gene Golden, and Olufemi with me. In 1984, we did a festival tour. It was really challenging. I remember it took me about 2 years to get over it, because we had only ever played one concert, and it was two sets. Each was about an hour and a half long, so we played about 3 hours of music on our very first concert, and then we were playing a circuit of 45-minute festival hits with incredible musicians from the jazz and folkloric music worlds, and I was looking for ways to feature everybody, but I was really letting it be a democracy, counting on everybody's finesse, and some people just didn't know when to stop, and the solos went on forever. Before you knew it, the 45-minute set was over, and I never felt like I got it together, because then we'd hit the road, rush to the next thing. I had 14 people. I had somebody who booked the tour who was on the road with us, who basically was getting drunk every night, and we'd have to get him out of bed.
Okay.
he's getting paid a per diem, and he wasn't handling anything for me. I was waking everyone up, getting everybody on the bus, doing everything at Sound. There's nobody to help me with anything. And it was my first tour as a leader.
Wow.
It was kind of overwhelming. And then anything that went wrong, you know, there were some people in the band that started to fuss, you know. And things could go wrong because those who set it up, for example, we flew from Finland, we're going to Berlin, and we had to change planes. And he who arranged it never arranged for our baggage to go through. So we had to go get our baggage, recheck it in on a long trip, you know, and things like that, you know. And then there was one locale where people had to double up on rooms, and no one expected that. But we did good to have a 14-piece group at that time, making decent money per person for 2.5 weeks with single rooms for everybody throughout except for that one. And I remember some people fussing on the tour and say, yeah, if this was my tour, this wouldn't happen. And the very same person, like years later, we ran into each other in the street, and he was with the young lady, and he introduced me. Hey, this is Michelle Rose woman. She took me on the best tour I ever went on.
Wow. It's amazing how things change as time goes by.
It's funny. You know, I felt bad. You know, I was doing the best I could. And I remember coming back, and Arthur Blythe asked me, so how'd it go? And I said, phew. It really kicked my booty, Arthur. I mean, I'm so tired. He was unsympathetic. He said, hey, you got to pay the cost to be the boss. And that's all he had to say. No sympathy. So it was all right. It's the reality,
sure.
You know. So I got some good training. Actually, Billy Bang was the first tour I ever did. He took me to Europe for my first time, and that was an initiation, too.
How so?
On the road with a bunch of men, places I'd never been, dealing with individual personalities and things. I'll just kind of leave that alone for the moment. But it was great. It's all the experience, you know.
Right.
Plus, at that time, really, Billy stuck his neck out to bring me in the band. It's interesting because just today, Baikita and I were talking, and he was saying how throughout the years he's had women in his bands, mm-hmm. and he's always got a lot of slack for it, you know.
I was wondering about that, actually, because in the recordings that I've gathered with you, you're primarily the only woman there, except for Terry Lynn Carrington on Quintessence, your own recordings as a leader.
Well, there were very few women playing at the time. It's
right.
different today. And, you know, I went through my period, especially coming up in the Bay Area as a young woman, where politics and political thinking was a given. And I started to look at the world through the lens of being a woman in this society for a while, long enough to get really mad, realize and understand a lot of things, and decide that this is not going to be the lens through which I focus my life. It's too limited, because I had been brought up in a home where my parents were very politically active for all human rights, for civil rights, and my vision was broader than just to think of the whole world through the lens of a woman and me as an oppressed female. But it was very good for me to get mad and realize some things. A lot of people wonder if Rose Woman came out of a feminist move, which it did not at all.
Rose Woman, your name?
My name, yeah. So Rose Woman was a name that was given me in my teens. And it stuck, and it had spiritual significance, and it wasn't until a lot of years later that I said, hey, yeah, that's right, Rose Woman. And I thought about it, and I said, that's a good thing. It was fitting for me in a lot of ways, and it came to me through very special people. And then spiritually, I was told it was a rightful name. But that was not a feminist move. My own family was oppressed for various reasons, for our beliefs, for our backgrounds, for our political involvements, for things of that nature. And I always felt that I was a member of a jazz community that was oppressed in general. But yeah, I was the only woman just about all the time, except on Greg Osby's Greg used that whole M-Bass circle, used Terry Lynn a lot. She was a part of it. And other than that, Olufemi Mitchell, who sang with my New Yoruba ensemble. And then when I would perform with Puntilla's group, there were the dancers, or there were a lot of women, so there were women in the dressing room, a bunch of us together singing, dancing.
On the new Yoruba release, are you dubbing your vocals, or do you have other...
Oh, there's a young lady that we brought in, really at the recommendation of, there's an organization called Havana Harlem, who has been excited about new Yoruba for many years. They co-produced us some years ago at the Painted Bride. People should be aware of Nela Martinez and Onel Mulet, and they are doing a lot of culturally based presentations, and they're very vital in the community and the continuum of the music. So they are involved in a co-production capacity with the recording, and it was their suggestion suggestion that I bring in this young lady on vocals for the chorus, because I like to have three-part harmony, and we don't want to use he who sings Apong Gia lead in the koro. It's not traditional, and it's beautiful to hear the lead singer be the lead singer and then to hear the chorus. So myself and Abraham Rodriguez have basically live been doing all the singing, although Roman Diaz sings too, but because you need the right range, depending on the key the song is in, to get the three-part harmonies. So we brought in Nina Rodriguez, and she's on some tracks. Anywhere there's vocals, I'm singing. I feature myself more on vocals than I ever had on this recording. By myself on a number of things, just singing things that don't involve koro. I'm singing koro on everything. On some things, I've overdubbed myself. So there's two of me. We did our vocal overdubs separately in the studio, although Pedrito Martinez did all his at the time. He came in and he did a few things in the vocal overdub session as well. And we brought Nina in for that. Nina and the tracks are listed that she's singing on. She brought a wonderful, a very folkloric quality to the choruses, to the coros. And her presence on there is a perfect touch, thanks to Neda's suggestion.
Now, the person who is leading,
Pedro Martinez, Pedrito.
He just sounds amazing.
Pedrito is a star. He is una estrella. He is a one in a billion. I met him in 98 when he came. New Yoruba had a concert at Tishman Auditorium, and Puntilla brought him to rehearsal. He was here also, El Gato, Ernesto Gatel from Yoruba Andao, as Roman Diaz says, Roman came out of Yoruba Andao. But Puntilla brought El Gato and Pedro to my rehearsal, and they ended up being the drummers along with Puntilla and Eddie Bobé for our concert at Tishman in 98. And the next year or later that year, we went on tour in California. And so I had the honor of bringing Pedro on his first tour ever in the U.S., and also the honor of bringing Puntilla to California for the first and only time, and they were waiting for him out there. Mm. Pedro is a natural, great musician, and in his first years here, he won the Thelonious Monk competition for percussion, and it really launched his career. He is an incredible percussionist, vocalist, and musician, period, and he's been a great blessing to this ensemble. When Puntilla passed 2008, Pedro took his seat in the band. And to replace Puntilla is a tall order, vocally in particular. I mean, every way, because he's everyone's teacher, including Pedrito's and including Roman. And it's a real honor for me that, and I found this out through Roman, because he knew of New Yoruba while in Cuba, and it was his dream to be a part of the project. And when I heard that, I can't tell you how I felt. It tells me I'm doing something not right, but that which I'm supposed to do. I mean, I know that, but it just confirms that for me. So Puntilla's presence in the ensemble had a lot to do with people hearing about it. And so he brought Pedro into the group, and I'm really honored that he's on the recording. The recording is the way it is and what it is because of Pedrito's presence. In other words, I geared it according to the fact that I had him in there to do what he does. His own career right now is at a peak. This is his moment. And he is everywhere with his own band. It's a whole other thing, but it's what he wants to be doing. So he's basically unavailable to everybody and anybody for now. And
what is his own band?
The Rito Martinez Group. Look it up. It's got a wide reach to huge audiences, the kinds of things they're doing. And he's got great, amazing players with him, and it's a very small unit that has played together so much. They're so tight, you know, it's just really something to hear. They play Guantanamera regular. Basically, that's his place 7 nights a week, but he's only there a few nights a week because he's on the road a lot.
Where's that?
It's on 9th Avenue in the 50s. And a lot of people go through just to hear him. Oh, he's wonderful. He's my abure. He's my friend, my asocio. He's been wonderful for the group, and I'm going to miss him because he's not going to be with us in the period to come. So it set me into, you know, a new period. That's all I can say. New Yoruba has existed since 1983. We're 30 years old, in a sense, with many evolutions, and this is a new evolution. I'm very excited now as well as to what we're becoming at this moment. And, you know, as you know, the CD release events involve different personnel and things.
Well, that's actually where I was going. And I want to mention, because there will be a ticket giveaway, the event that you have at Dizzy's coming up. You want to Tell us about that.
We're hoping that you'll feel entirely fulfilled by what you hear. Some of the same horn players won't be there because they weren't available. And so this is the thing about the music. There's a natural thing there that happens. And it's led me to a moment now where I have someone in the ensemble that I've never worked with who was my idol in California when I heard Lee Morgan's last recording, which now they call The Last Session.
The Last Session, yeah.
But it was a double album, and it was called Capra Black.
Mm-hmm. Lily Harper! A former Sugar guest.
And, you know, I have to say, you know, I've never worked with Billy, but Billy Harper's working with New Yoruba.
Excellent.
Yeah,
excellent.
And we've had a couple of rehearsals, and it's just amazing. I have a first CD release event up at Lake George on September 14th, and I have Billy Harper, Antonio Hart, Alex Norris on trumpet, Stafford Hunter on trombone, and Howard Johnson on baryon tuba. I have the same rhythm section as the recording, Junior Terry and Adam Cruz. On Bata, neither Roman or Pedro will be there. Roman is busy. So I have Abraham Rodriguez, Abby Holiday, and Nikki LaBoy. At Dizzy's, I will have Billy Harper and Antonio Hart, Freddie Hendricks, who's on the recording, Vincent Gardner, Howard Johnson, Greg August on bass because Junior is not available, and Greg's wonderful, Adam on drums, and I'll have Roman Diaz, Abby Holiday, and Abraham Rodriguez.
Okay.
So I'll have two of three bata players and most of the horn players and part of the rhythm section. A lot of carryover from the recording, and we are playing the music from the recording.
And on the subject of the recording specifically, since 1983, there had been no recordings of this. How did you decide that you were going to have a recording? The two CD set 30 years later?
Actually, earlier last year, I was still thinking about doing a Kickstarter project to do a solo piano recording, which I've never done. And some very good friends of mine took me out for dinner for a belated birthday. And I went to the restroom, and when I came back, Nilsa said, "Michelle, Tom has something he wants to say." I said, "Oh, okay." And Tom said, "You know, this is a good idea and everything, but you need to record New Yoruba." Tomas Pena, who's part of the Latin Jazz Network and a very good friend. And it was like a light went off. And you know you're right, and that was it. The next day, I was on the phone with those who I knew immediately I wanted on the recording to start to find out people's schedules and to see how I could get 10. It turned into 11, because originally we were 14-piece, and we've been 10-piece for a long time, but now we're 11-piece. And I started that very next day, which would have been probably April of last year, to organize everything and to get the likes of musicians that I got, to find the time period that everybody could make all the rehearsals, the studio dates, and some performances, because my goal was to perform before we went to the studio. And so it all came together. It was a lot of work. The Kickstarter thing, first of all, in and of itself is a huge project. It was a great way to go. It brought a huge buzz to the whole thing. Not to mention the funding that it brought.
You met your goal.
We met our goal.
You exceeded your goal, actually.
Yeah, by a few dollars. Right. And but that goal, we did not ask for near what we needed, because, you know, they say it freaks people out to see those large numbers. They think you're not going to get in and they don't contribute, or they're less likely. So we put a much lower number for that, and it's a huge expense. I just had to find a way to deal with it all these years that it hadn't happened and not feel bad about it. And the more people got into kind of mixing these genres, the more uncomfortable it felt for me that I hadn't done it yet, because factually speaking, I'm one of the first to bring those worlds together musically, and the only to do it the way that I do it, which is where the piece kept coming back to me through the years, because I realized nobody could quite do what I do.
And because there have been other groups that have done it afterwards, I guess. There was, what, Santissimo, Synthesis.
Well, Santissimo was just years ago. That's very recent.
Right.
Synthesis was quite a while ago, and much more electronic.
Right, exactly.
And also very, very, very different with Lázaro Ross, you know, mm-hmm. a huge influence for all of us.
Mm-hmm.
Wonderful, some beautiful stuff there, you know.
Right.
I remember one time Puntilla calling me up, and all I could hear was music on the phone, and he was playing me something from that recording. But we were already busy doing stuff like that also. But here in particular, and Irakere was mixing things, but not
right.
from the same jazz standpoint, much more traditional jazz.
Right.
I think that it's safe to say I'm really one of the first that brought them together, and the only to do it the way I do it, because I'm a true composer with a concept. I think that the way that I do it is bound to be uniquely me. But it's been nerve-wracking. It's a big project. The budget, I had numerous recordings on NJA, and I'd hoped they would do it. They couldn't take on that budget. And what I have to represent the group musically is live recordings that are so-so in terms of quality or execution, where I didn't always have my first choice players. Always, everyone who played with this band contributed a lot, but I've never been able to manifest my vision completely in terms of this band. And this recording, it does that. And one of the great things is I can hand this live recording to all the musicians who come through the band now, and they know exactly what I'm trying to do. I didn't have live representation of all the material that I would hand anybody to say, here's what we're trying to do. So it makes the continuation of the band much easier.
Now, this label, what is it?
Advanced Dance Discs. That's my own label. Starting with my last release, which was a Fifth Quintessence recording called The Inside Out. That was my first ever on my own label. I always had record company associations. You know, I really never wanted to go this route. It's a lot of financial responsibility, time commitment. It's a whole other animal. You got to handle everything. And if you're going to put all that money into the recording, you want to have a publicist and radio marketing, and everything costs money. And my last one was, for me, what I consider very expensive. Who knows if it ever reimburses itself, and now I went and done this one. Mm-hmm. But with Kickstarter backing, it definitely has made a huge difference, and it made it possible. So this is the second one on my own label, Advance Dance Discs.
Now, let's talk about the Dizzy events. You've got the dates?
Sure. September 30th and October 1st. It's a Monday and Tuesday. The Mondays, the first set, 7:30 set, is a WBGO live broadcast. You know, I had a choice of days through the week. I went with this because the Monday BGO broadcast is a very nice aspect of it. I believe the sets are 7:30 and 9:30 both nights. Right before the set, there's something done. I think we're on the air right before the concert for a few minutes, and then the concert is live.
Oh, great. Do you know who's hosting?
Rhonda.
Yay! Rhonda, yay! Rhonda Hamilton. Something we always talk about on Sugar in My Bowl, for the guests who happen to be doing it, teaching. I understand that you had been teaching at NYU and are presently substitute teaching at the New School?
Yeah, actually I've been teaching since before I moved to New York. I taught at the Haight-Ashbury Music Workshop. I don't know, I fell into that, and little by little it's just become a very integral part of my life. I've always given private lessons in piano composition. I had been Reggie Workman's sub for about 18 years at the New School. I also have subbed regular for many years now for Billy Harper, recently for George Cables. Before that I was, God bless him, Benny Powell's sub, and Chico Freeman's before that. A lot of subbing at the New School. At NYU, I was actually on faculty there for a little while, I think about a year and a half. And I'm a part of a program in Montclair, New Jersey, that's existed for 18 years. It used to be called Jazz Connections, and it took place at Montclair State University, but for the last 3 years has been under the auspices of the Jazz House Kids.
Excellent.
And that's Melissa Walker and Christian McBride. So this was our third year, my third year there, but my 18th year as part of the program. And I met, for example, Tyshawn Sorey when he was 15 years old.
Drummer.
Yeah. He started studying ensemble and composition. At the New School, I've been teaching ensemble mainly, and then some private students at NYU. I did piano lab and private piano students. At the Montclair program, I've been teaching composition, ensemble, piano. And so, yes, Tyshawn, I actually took him on his first European tour when he was 18. He went with Quintessence. And we have a trio called the Time and Textures Trio with Liberty Elman on guitar, Tyshawn, myself, and Liberty, playing all of our musics. But this is all to say that the young players that I meet, and a lot of them at this Montclair program in particular, incredible. I always say it's like there's something in the water over there, because the enthusiasm, the level, it's kind of frightening sometimes. People got to keep their eye on that program, Jazz House Kids, on the kids coming out of it. A bunch of them just came through there. They've gotten into the New School, into Juilliard. They're winning all the competitions. They're winning all the prizes, the ones coming out of this program. And credit goes as well to the woman that started it, Janet Lemansky, who was a public school music teacher who started recruiting and formed this very grassroots program. And she brought me in early on, and then later on I recommended, she talked to Billy Hart, and she brought him in. Billy moved to Montclair. You know, there's a huge community of musicians out there. So teaching is something that I love. And it's like breathing. It's like I don't feel the need to prep for it ever, because I'm not formulaic. I'm reading what's in front of me. And I feel I have a real knack for knowing what every individual needs next. Well, I bring what I do in the sense that I'm very geared towards having a unique rhythm section. The rhythm section to me makes and breaks a group, and if it's completely standard in approach, it doesn't matter how interesting what's going on top of it, it's going to detract from the uniqueness of the music. And there's a lot to being a kind of interactive conversational rhythm section. The role for piano, bass, and drums is something that I think not enough time spent on in a general sense, not addressed enough in classroom contexts, although a lot of unique players address it within their own ensembles because they want that too. And a lot of the nuances, the things that are hard to teach because it comes from doing it a lot, the gray zone, that which makes the music deep, the subtle, kind of unspoken things that come with experience. Because today you have a lot of very virtuosic, just at that age before even having much experience. But there's huge gaps in their knowledge. But because they're very good in some ways, they want to appear good all the time, so they'll sidestep the things they don't do well. But you can't...
Like what, for instance?
They might not want to play a tune because it'll show them what they don't know, or it'll show you what they don't know. For example, a lot of the piano players, they've got an amazing right hand. But when they start to comp, you can't even believe how uninformed they are as to what it takes and what's missing and what they're doing, because the contrast is so huge. The things they aren't doing that are so essential to this music, you know, so you find ways to fill gaps, to address those things in a way that you handle their emotions so that they don't feel bad and they're able to learn from what you teach. It's a lot to teaching, and I love it. Don't think when you play. Play something you would never think to play. You know, there's a lot of things you can do. So I really do, as you can tell, I'm getting excited. I love to teach, and there's magic that has to happen for that kind of music to work. And a lot of people speak in terms of, why play like that? You sound like a bunch of kids playing anything. It was interesting, actually, because at the Montclair program, I was really surprised, actually, when they brought Oliver in, because it's sort of more traditional-based program, but they're really stretching their wings a lot. So last year they brought Oliver in, and he played for the entire student body, and he asked a bunch of us up one by one. He had Freddie Hendrix come up, and people that play with him, Bruce Williams, he had me come up, Annie McKee, and it was pure improv that we did. And there was one young student, a drummer, and Billy Hart, we were all up there. So he came up on Billy after we played, came up on him and said, what was that? Why did you do that? He was, like, really upset. And there was a young man that studied with Billy, Mike Mohammed, who's become a great drummer in his own right, who started, take it easy, man, take it easy. What's the matter? And he started talking to him. He said, kids could do that. I could just get up there and play anything. And Mike said, did you not notice when Billy pulled out his brushes? You see, he did that because there was a particular texture that Oliver was creating that he was responding to. There's nothing arbitrary about that. Did you not notice when he started breaking down what Billy did? And so it was really interesting because the reaction was like that at first from some of the kids because they didn't know what to think. And then, in fact, that very day later, Oliver told me they had a Q&A thing, and their minds got really opened up just by discussing it. And so that's the process. You know, this music does include all of that. Our music that we call jazz is a huge, broad thing that only other people limit. Us as musicians, we don't limit it. And as musicians, we're pretty expansive. It's others that need to categorize. If someone is playing their instrument and they're not into the sound of their instrument, it doesn't matter what notes they play. If they haven't gotten deep into what that instrument offers in terms of sound, their touch on the piano, their sound on the saxophone or the trumpet is going to fall way short. And no matter how hip the notes, you will not be memorable because you didn't touch anybody with the sound of your instrument. That's what touches. Not so much the notes you choose to play, but the way you play them and the sound that is created.
Now, your experience of learning or growing musically didn't happen in the university, for the most part. However, that seems to be the place where new musicians are learning. Do you see there being more of a possibility, although there's less presently, where people can learn outside of the university like you did?
There's plenty of that around, you know. Once you're in school, you got a lot of demands, and the amount of money folks are paying to go to school, they better make that their priority. But there's nothing like that other level of learning. And actually, you know, the new school was, I think, set up with that in mind by the kind of faculty they established. They're working musicians in their field. But there's I've observed a lack of respect there that's been at times pretty shocking. I've heard students talking in the elevator. This is not, I'm not saying anything about the students in general at the school or anything, but just to say that one of the things they should know when they're going to that kind of school is that they have an opportunity to learn from the greats. It is in a school setting, but I had many a class where I asked the band members who were in Billy Harper's ensemble that I was subbing for example, how many of you have listened to Billy Harper on recordings? One hand went up. How many of you have ever heard Billy Harper live? No hands went up. I said, are you telling me that you've been in Billy Harper's class for the last 3 months playing his music and you never listened to him? Is that an opportunity lost? You know, that's unthinkable for folks that learned from the hang, you know. Mm-hmm. It's the sounds of New York. What you gonna do? leave it. You know. It's still the way to learn, you know. I've met a lot of new school students that were really wonderful that I really kept in my mind. I should have got names and numbers and things because then I got so involved in other projects. But, for example, when it comes to Quintessence, it's really on a back burner. But when I come out again with that group, it's going to be all new. It's going to be new players. And I want to have sessions. That's what I always did. I'd have sessions and find some new young players that really, for me, were right for what I'm hearing for the band.
So are you saying that that's where you'll go to, say, new school or...
Well, some of the folks I've met, you know, the young players that I have in mind that I meet through the schools, I'll be inviting them. And some of them ask me, if you ever have a session, I hope you'll consider me. They want a chance. They want a shot at the music. And that expressed enthusiasm, they've listened to me, and they want to get to that, they want a chance. That's the best starting point in the world to me. And then that's where the hang comes in, you know.
Okay.
I don't know if I'm a rare breed at this point, you know, those that did not learn in college and university. I think less in the younger generations, but there's a bunch of us that, you know, did not get degrees. I mean, in some ways I wish I had. But that time, I can't imagine what years would I have not done what I did. Every year has been a vital year in my progression that I wouldn't give up for anything. It would have disconnected everything. I wouldn't be here with you now with this release 30 years later of something that is probably my, I don't know, I've heard people around me say my, what's the word they use? Legacy project. In that, this is something I had to do while on the planet. I had to manifest it for the public. And my getting to this is through my hanging in two worlds. A moment that I had that a lot of people today are going to miss these kind of moments. They'll never have them. Was when I think I had moved to New York already. And I would come back to Oakland to visit family. And I'd always pop in on Ed. I used to laugh because I'd come through. By the way, when I went to the junior college there, I was in the big band and I took a harmony class for 2 semesters. I never enrolled. I never got credits. Talk about the hang. I didn't care about anything except being in the right environment. So I would come back and Ed would be at the chalkboard and I would just be laughing. They made him act like a real teacher, you know, and he had to do it on that level. I'd be out the door looking at him and laughing and he'd be trying to run the class.
Right, right.
But I would go to the clubs where he held jam sessions and I went and Ed would sit in behind 40 saxophonists, one after the other. I wrote a poem for Ed about that, just how he kept that fire burning. Because he could have been world famous and he turned down opportunities to go on the road in order to stay and raise his family and raise a lot of young jazz musicians. Suddenly somebody was playing that. I said, wow, who is that? And I looked, I said, what? Is that Pharoah? It was Pharoah Sanders because they're very, very close.
Right.
And next thing I knew, we sitting across the street, me, Ed, and Pharoah in the Chinese restaurant eating. Mm-hmm. Next thing I know, we're in a VW van. I'm sitting in the back seat between Ed and Pharoah, and whoever's driving has Coltrane on real loud.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember my leg was just going. I was going, you know. It was running through my body.
Yeah.
And Ed said, yeah, Mick, exciting, isn't it? And what could I say?
Yeah.
I was excited. You know, it was the beginnings. And then in the world of Cuban folklore, the hang is much deeper. It demands a lot, and it gives back a lot. And you get the deepest things from that. Those things that you wouldn't know otherwise, especially at a young age, you know. To be on the verge of making this music available to the public and getting to share it, I'm just so excited. September 10th release date. What's today? September 8th, and it's being released in 2 days. And I just want to say to the public that you can go to my, even 2 days before the release, you can go to MichelleRoseWoman.com/NewYoruba. That's MichelleRoseWoman.com/NewYoruba. A page especially for this ensemble where there are excerpts of all the tracks. Then the CD itself will be available through CD Baby for sure, starting September 10th, and likely through my website as well, and eventually through Amazon, iTunes, and everything. It became a 2-CD set. I had no idea that that's what it was going to be, but as I started looking at all the music we had recorded and the editing process, I can't think about how long this is going to be. I just have to keep what's best of every track and figure out later what not to use. And somebody said you could make it a 2-CD set. And again, a light went off. It makes it even more special. And it is a lot of years of conceiving all of this to where it makes sense I would have more music than I could squeeze into one spot. So it's 2 CDs, 7 tracks each, a total of 110 minutes of music. And not one track to the next is the same. And within one track, it takes you on a whole journey featuring masters of both worlds, great soloists. The folklorists are the best in the country, truly. These are the masters here, and they're on the recording. And the bata that you hear, the vocals that you hear, they're all pure, they're right, they're correct, and they are featured. You know, some songs start with it and end with it. Some right in the middle, you get a dose of nothing but folklore. A lot of compositional elements that are completely integrated with the folklore. I think I can almost say that most people could probably listen if they had the time and the headspace, because in this day and age, it's hard to come by. If you were to listen through the whole thing, I bet you won't get bored.
No, you definitely won't get bored. That I can most certainly say. I was not bored, and I listened again and again, and I'm still listening, so... Thank you so much, Michelle Rosewoman, for Michelle Rosewoman's New Yoruba, for hanging with us. And we look forward to seeing you on either September 30th or October 1st at Dizzy's Cloud Coca-Cola and at jalc.org/DCC. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And that was Michelle Rosewoman. This is Sugar in My Bowl. My name is Joyce Jones, and I'd like to thank Hank Williams for the bandstand, and I'd like to thank Michelle Rosewoman most definitely for all of the useful information that she had shared, and for sharing her career and her journey with us, and this New Yoruba collection, this 2-CD set, as mentioned. It features, as mentioned, Freddie Hendrix on trumpet, flugelhorn, Oliver Lake, soprano and alto saxophone and flute, Mike Lee on tenor saxophone, Vincent Gardner on trombone, Howard Johnson on baritone saxophone tuba, that's a former Sugar guest, Michelle Rosewoman on piano and vocals, Junior Terry, Yosvani Terry's brother, on bass, Adam Cruz on drums, Pedrito Martinez, Pedro Martinez, who was mentioned, the star, Estrella, on lead vocals, bata and congas, Roman Diaz, whom I was introduced to playing with Milford Graves this past summer at Vision Festival, Abraham Rodriguez, Daniel Carbonelli, on bata, congas, and vocals, and the Michelle Rosewoman's New Yoruba is released on and will be available on Tuesday, September 10th on Advanced Discs Records 2013, and that is Michelle Rosewoman's label. And before, what are we listening to now? We are listening to Where Waters Meet, Sky, Yemoya. And before that, we heard Newton Baby, Michelle Rosewoman Quartet from The Source, Michelle Rosewoman's release as a leader. And let's see, what do I need to do? I need to do something. Oh, I'd like to thank and congratulate Ivy Colton. She is the winner of the Monday, September 30th, Dizzy's Club tickets to see Michelle Rosewoman. Yay! Hopefully I'll see her then. Hopefully I'll see some of the other listeners there as well. And as mentioned, I mentioned
jalc.org/DCC, but it will immediately take you to DIZZYS for Dizzy's Club. Coming up next is La Nueva Alternativa. We'll be back on the 22nd, and we're trying to get Kenny Garrett, so we'll see what happens. Stay tuned. This is WBAI New York, 99.5 FM.
Hello, bueno, this is Sonia Sanchez. I urge you to give your generous support to listener-sponsored community radio, WBAI 99.5 FM in New York.